yellow basket.
Good morning and welcome to the February edition of Black Book Talk. I am Patricia Welch, Librarian Emeritus. This month I have another name next month, another title next month.
And I'm Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman. Good morning.
We'll be here with Mirror Image Books. Let's read, walk, and talk.
And we have a special guest this morning. We are welcoming
Joyce Harris,
community leader, who's going to bring us some information about a wonderful, two wonderful events that are coming up this month that are ones directly related to this interview. But happily this morning, once again, we have Renee Watson, who promised to come back and tell us when her latest book, Betty Before X, was published. And welcome, Renee. I think it was published on the 18th of January?
No, it came out January 2nd.
January 2nd, okay.
Yes.
All right, well, still pretty hot off the press. Welcome.
Yes, very hot off the press. Thank you for having me.
Okay, you know something? We'd like you to open up with just reading a brief segment of the book so folks will know what we're talking about.
Sure. I will start from a scene in the book where Betty has tried to give a gift to her birth mom, and her birth mother doesn't accept it. And so she's pretty frustrated because at this point in the story, she's been trying and trying to get her birth mom to love her and trying to see change in the community, and she isn't seeing any change yet. So her friend is trying to encourage her.
Okay.
I stand in the parking lot holding the boxes, not able to move or speak or do anything. I don't know how much time passes before Kay is standing next to me. I don't realize that she's holding my hand until she says my name. Betty, Betty, not here. Don't cry here, Kay says. I put the gift in the trunk. Come with me. Let's walk, Kay says. She leads the way down the block, past the candy store, the bakery, the diner, to the park on the corner. We don't talk on our way. When we get to the park, we sit on swings and barely muster a sway. What happened? She asks. I tell her about Ollie Mae, tell her how mean she is, how she gave back my gift, a gift I made with my own hands just for her. I tell Kay, what's the point of doing unto others as you want them to do for you if this is what you get in return? Kay doesn't answer. And Pastor Daines can keep all those scriptures about sowing and reaping, because no matter how much good I try to do for Ollie Mae, nothing changes in our relationship. I just want her to love me. And even the Housewives League keeps trying to do good, but things aren't really changing. There are still stores that refuse to hire Negroes, still places where we go and get treated like we're nothing. My feet drag along the dirt, then I push myself just a little and swing back and forth. Kay lets me sit in my sadness for a moment. Then she asks, Betty, have you ever planted anything? No. Well, I have. It's hard work, Kay says. My family had a farm down south. I helped my mom with the garden. Before, we'd have to get rid of rocks, do a lot of digging, do what my mom calls breaking the earth. Kay is swinging now, back and forth, back and forth. She says, when I first started helping in the garden, I was like you. What do you mean? I ask. I was impatient, and I didn't understand how seeds and harvest time work. I thought as soon as I planted the seeds, I'd see growth the next day. But sometimes we wouldn't see any sign of growth for 10 days or 70 or even 3 years. 3 years? The apple tree my dad planted took forever to have fruit. I'd walk past it every day for 3 years just waiting. I'd be miserable if I had to wait that long. Didn't you get frustrated? Well, there was always work to do somewhere else on the farm. Depending on the time of year, something is always being planted or taking root or being watered or sprouting. And then there was the prepping for winter and recovering from seasons when there was a bad crop. So, yeah, we got frustrated a lot. Sometimes my mom would cry if she'd be so devastated. We had done the best we could, and all because of a drought or too much rain, we'd lose everything, Kay says. But just because you have a bad season doesn't mean you stop planting. We swing, propelling ourselves into the sky. No words, just the squeaky swing set, the clinking chains. Kay says, I think that scripture is not only about the harvest, but the work it takes to get the harvest and the patience it takes to wait.
Wow. So your new book, Betty X, is about Betty Shabazz during her early teen years?
Yes, her preteen years. She's 10 till about 12 in the book. And we have a little bit of her early childhood when she's one, when she was born in Pinehurst, Georgia. And the story follows her after she's taken from her birth mom and then lives with first her aunt, and then her aunt passes away. So she moves to Detroit and rejoins her birth mother. And then the story kind of goes from there, following her middle grade years.
Now, this book is a collaboration. Could you elaborate on that?
Sure. I was so honored to write this book with Ilyasa Shabazz, Malcolm and Betty's daughter. So it was such an honor for them to reach out to me to ask if I could be a part of this project. And we worked on it together and co-wrote the book. And now we're going to be out and about doing some events, sharing the work with young readers.
So, Renee, could you tell us a little bit about how that collaboration with Ilyasa Shabazz worked? Did she provide you with some of the stories that she heard from family members about her mom?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, our first interactions were just me listening and having her tell me stories, things that, you know, were kind of passed down through generations, and her memories of her mom. You know, we talked a lot, actually, about Betty's adulthood, because I really think, you know, who you are is who you've been. And so as an adult, Betty was really kind and generous and loved music and really cared about her family, was very protective of her family, really guarded female friendship very closely. And so in the book, we have her that same way in her childhood, where you kind of see the seedlings of that happening, where she's very mindful of her little sisters and very much close to her best friends, loving music and dancing in the bedroom with her friends, dancing to records. So yeah, I got a lot of stories from Ilyasa. I also read a ton of books, and we were able to interview Betty's sister, her half-sister. And so that was great, because, you know, you get those kinds of stories that you just are not going to find in a book somewhere. So she was really able to fill in some of the blanks for us, and that was very helpful. So after talking and interviewing people and reading and researching, we got to writing, and I would work on a few chapters, send them to Ilyasa, she'd add in, and we just kept going back and forth, refining the plot and talking about what kind of book we wanted this to be.
This is interesting. Now, this is a fictionalized version of Betty Shabazz's life. So, I mean, how close is this to what is actual? You know, will young readers meet a lot of people who hear about a lot of things that are totally made up, or what?
So the foundation of the story is very true. It's historical fiction because, you know, we weren't there, so we can't say these conversations happened in the exact same way that they are in the book. But everything as far as the structure of her life, growing up in Pinehurst and having a bruise on her neck that her grandmother was concerned about and wondering, who did that to you and what's going on in that household? That's kind of what triggers the story in the first few chapters, where she's taken from her birth mother. And then her aunt, who she's living with, passes away. So she has to go back to her birth mom, who by then has moved to Detroit and has a whole new life. She's remarried. She has other children. And so all of that is very much true. They went to Bethel AME in Detroit, and Betty really was a part of the Housewives League. So all of those things came right from real stories, real research that we did. And we just added in some of the other scenes of her and her friends and those conversations. But she was definitely the girl in the book is the girl who existed in real life, okay, as far as personality.
You mentioned friends as well as family. Did she have childhood friends that persisted even into adulthood?
Yeah, so Suzetta, who actually is a character in the book, is a real person and was friends with Betty throughout childhood into adulthood. So we were able to talk with her. We definitely kind of expanded their friendship, and just for the sake of the book, had to change some things, but we got a lot of the essence of their friendship in the book. They loved to bake cookies together and listen to records, and they were both volunteers for the Housewives League in Detroit.
The editorial process in this must have been sort of interesting.
What do you mean?
Who went over what you had collaborated on and made some definite changes?
Ah, I see. So yes, we edited each other. So, like, you know, I would write a few chapters, send them to Ilyasa. She'd give me feedback, add in paragraphs, change things, rearrange them. We'd do another round, and we would keep going until we felt like we had a solid draft, and then we gave it to our editor at FSG, who, her name is Grace Kendall, and she's amazing and really helped us highlight some of the things that really needed to come to light and then do away with things that weren't necessary. So yeah, we worked on the book for about a year before it actually became the book that's, you know, in your hands. And that was just drafting, going back and forth, making sure we were trying to get it just right. I'll add that part of the reason for that is, you know, so we know this story starts off in a tragic way, right? A mother abuses a child. There's a mark on her neck. And I think we wanted to make sure that the story didn't stay in that sadness. We're talking about the South. We're talking about the forest. There's so much that young Black girls had to see and endure back then. But we also wanted to make sure there was joy and that there was celebration and that this wasn't just the bad parts of her childhood, but that we were able to also highlight the strength and the power and the beauty of her childhood too. So that was what we kind of really were going back and forth about, is making sure there was balance in the story, which is really important to me, that our young girls, especially girls of color, can see themselves in book and not just be tragic and painful, but that they can see leadership and strength and some joy. So we worked on that a lot.
So Renee, I know that you are at heart, you're a teacher, and yeah. How do you envision this book being used as part of a curriculum or to just help our young women understand, you know, the trials and tribulations of growing up as a Black girl living in America?
Oh, I think there's so many curriculum tie-ins depending on what teachers are doing on their unit. One thing that comes to mind is giving some context to where we are now. Sometimes I talk to young people and they just don't know our history. So, you know, they kind of start with Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown. They'll know, of course, like Martin Luther King and Rosa Parks, but they have no context for like police brutality outside of what's current. And so going back to Emmett Till, going back to even in the book, Betty finds out about a young boy who is killed by the police even then, right? And so helping young people understand the continuum that they're on, that there have been activists fighting for change for many, many years, and asking them, what do you want to do to join in that struggle? And that it could be through many different ways. For Betty, because she lived in the North, her protesting and her activism looked different than maybe it did who was in the South. Right? She had a little more privilege, being that she was in the North, but still was dealing with racism. I think it's an opportunity to talk to young people about choices and to ask them how they want to be involved. Not if they want to be involved, but how. How do you want to respond to injustice, and how are you going to continue the fight that was started on your behalf? So I think those are some questions that educators can ask young people.
You're listening to Black Book Talk on KBOO FM 90.5 Portland. How is this a book? How has writing this book affected you? You're delving into, you know, I mean, just really a magnificent life, but most of us have only known little portions of it, and unfortunately, the messages that a lot of us get, you know, the things that are most represented about Betty Shabazz is like she was Malcolm's wife. Mm-hmm. And he died, and you know her daughter, had an emotional break, and that her grandson might have been was responsible for her death. So, to get the full picture about this woman, what did that mean to you?
I'm still processing all of that. You know, it feels very surreal to have history literally sitting next to me. I'm talking with Ilyasa. I feel very honored, and it just reminds me how important it is to preserve stories and to really make sure that our stories get told from us, you know, by us. I think so many times outsiders come and try to co-opt our stories and make it what they want it to be, or like I was saying earlier, make it only about the sadness and the pain. Talking to Ilyasa and really being immersed in her life, in Betty's life, just reminded me of how powerful Black women are, how resilient you can be after tragedy after tragedy. And it just kind of energized me to make sure that I keep going, that no matter how hard or bad or frustrated things get, there can always be the comeback, and that you can just keep pushing and thriving and trying.
Speaking of happy times, I was just reminded that after Betty Shabazz's death, Nikki Giovanni came to Portland and spoke, and afterwards she was just having a talk with people sitting around, and she was saying that she remembered a time when she was in the same town as Betty, and Betty had made a speech, and she and some other friends were in a limousine, so they waited for her, and they took her out to dinner, and how they had laughed and laughed. So I took it from what she was saying that she was a pretty jovial, social kind of person.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, she loved to laugh and have fun, and there's so many stories from her friends talking about that side of her, and talking about the part of her that, which came from her adoptive mom, who kind of always said to her, find the joy and praise it. The theme in the book, where whenever Betty is frustrated and kind of, you know, having her pity party, which she rightly deserved to have, her adopted mom would remind her that there's something to praise always. And so I think she carried that throughout her life of like, yes, it's hard, but it's hard for so many people. And I think she just made a decision, a choice to push through the sadness and to find some joy. So yeah, there's so many stories that I would find and hear about her being this very happy, bright light, and really encouraging other people when they were going through.
You are a very, very creative writer. And at a time now when child abuse is a big subject, this really comes at a real interesting time. How are you going to promote this in that area of activity?
Well, it's interesting. I was thinking about like what all the things that now just him being on the forefront of people's minds in a way I don't think we have in a while. So Yeah, it's also about blended families and thinking about what does it mean to know your birth mom and maybe have a challenging relationship with her to be adopted by this other family. There's just so much about family dynamics in the also read this book to their children and talk about family legacy and maybe uncover some of those secrets. I think there's scenes in the book where Betty is wondering a lot about her past, and she's having kind of flashbacks. She remembers some things, but there's still a lot of questions. And I know a lot of young people who are like that, who like kind of remember but don't fully remember. And when is it appropriate to tell them the whole story of who they are, where they come from? And so I'm hoping that families have conversations about their origin and what legacy that their family has.
You know, we know you're coming to town soon because you come home every February. And one of the reasons why we invited Sister Joyce is so that she could talk about these events. So, Joyce.
Yeah, so I want to just first of all say that this is going to be a phenomenal day here in Portland. It fits in very well with Black History Month because Sister Betty is indeed a part of our history. The first event will be at the North Portland Branch Library, located at 512 North Killingsworth Street, and it will be hosted by
Kirby Curtis, who is the new manager
there. The new manager. And this will be a tea, and it's really targeting younger sisters, mothers, grandmas. It'll be a sisterhood event. And the unique thing about this event is that we've gotten 50 books donated, and if anybody listening to this that wants to also help and donate a couple of books, that would be great. And the first 50 or more girls who come will get a free autographed copy of Betty Before X. And they have to be 18 and under. So if you're 45, don't try to get a book. The second event that I'd like to just plug is there's a sister, her name is Dr. Nadine Burke Harris. She's a pediatrician who's done extensive research and treatment of children whose lives have been impacted by adverse childhood experiences, which is ACEs. And she's written a new book, The Deepest Well, Healing the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. She will be at Powell's on Monday, February 5th at 7:30 p.m. And that's located at 1005 West Burnside. Last event, Black History Proclamation at Portland City Council, January 31st, from 2 to 4:30 p.m. And that, I'm sorry, from 2:30 to 4 p.m. And this year's Black History Month theme is honoring those men and women in our community who have served in wars.
And I know there's something else significant in terms of African-American cultural history is taking place today. And Renee, I'd like you to tell us about that because you've been so involved with it.
Well, today is the anniversary of I2 Arts Collective officially opening. And if, for those who don't know, I2 Arts Collective is a nonprofit that I started, and we're housed in the home where Langston Hughes lived in Harlem. So I'm really excited and proud. We've been existing for a full year now, and today's his birthday. So
that's right.
It's such an honor to be talking with you and to be sharing about Betty on Langston's birthday and just all of it tying in. So Portland was so supportive with helping me raise funds for the Brownstone, and so I just am thankful for my Portland community reaching all the way out to the East Coast to help me get this thing off the ground.
And as an eyewitness, someone who's fortunate enough to go and visit the Langston Hughes house, see his typewriter, see letters that he wrote, just feel his spirit, I'm honored to talk to you. You do us proud. And I do want to say that for those of you who want a little more Renee before she gets here, on Tuesday, February 13th at 6 p.m., Paige Turner's Black Voices at the North Portland Library will be reading this or discussing This Side of Home by Renee. And you can go by the library now, pick up your copy, read it, come back on the 13th and be prepared to talk a little bit more. So I think we've come to the end of our time slot. So this is Patricia Welch, the library lady, saying happy Black History Month to all of you. And
Emma Jackson Ford, good. Emma Jackson Ford, bookwoman.
O.B. Hill, Reflections, Mirror Image Books, Let's Read, Walk, and Talk.
Joyce Harris, community activist and book aficionado, used to manage the Talk and Drum bookstore for the Black Educational Center.
The Friends of Books. Everybody have a great February. Have a great Black History Month.
Tisket, a tasket, a brown and yellow basket. I send a letter to my mommy on the way. I dropped it, I dropped it, I dropped it. Yes, on the way I dropped it. A little girlie picked it up and put it in her pocket. She was trucking on down the avenue with not a single thing to do. She went a peck, peck, pecking all around. When she spied it on the ground, she took it, she took it, my little yellow basket. And if she doesn't bring it back, I think that I will die. A tisket, a tasket, I lost my yellow basket. And if that girlie don't return it, don't know what I'll do. Oh gee, I wonder where my basket can be.
My yellow basket.
Won't someone help me find my basket? Make me happy again, again. No, 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 no. No, 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 no. No, 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 no. Just a little yellow basket. A little yellow basket.
And it's 11:57. We're going to go right ahead with the KBOO News at Noon for Thursday, February 1st, 2018. An Oregon State University student is facing hate crime charges for allegedly placing racist stickers on cars in Corvallis last year. Andrew Joseph Allswalt faces two counts of first-degree intimidation, each a Class C felony carrying up to 5 years in prison upon conviction, according to an indictment filed Tuesday in Benton County Circuit Court. Allswalt is also charged with two counts of third-degree criminal mischief, each carrying a penalty of up to 30 days in jail if found guilty. Allswalt and another man who have not been identified are accused of affixing stickers to cars at the First Alternative Natural Foods Co-op on June 17th last year. The stickers read, "Racism is a horrible disease. You catch it from N-words." The stickers were placed on cars belonging to members of a group called Showing Up for Racial Justice, which was meeting at the co-op. In Puerto Rico, while millions of people still lack clean drinking water and electricity, the legislature this week decided to prioritize a bill to discriminate against LGBTQ people in the U.S. territory. The so-called Religious Freedom Bill will allow government employees to discriminate against LGBTQ people. While lawmakers have authored such measures in state legislatures across the U.S., This vote came while 35% of Puerto Ricans still do not have power or running water in the wake of Hurricane Maria. Reports that FEMA was planning to withdraw aid this week have drawn stern criticism. A new report from Vice magazine asserts that Trump-appointed officials at the Office of Refugee Resettlement reportedly suggested an experimental method to reverse a medication-induced abortion attained by a 17-year-old undocumented immigrant in custody. According to the report, Director Scott Lloyd, who has written articles promoting the inclusion of anti-contraceptive efforts in the anti-choice movement, discussed with other administration staff members the use of the hormone progesterone to reverse the abortion after it was underway last March. This method has not been proven to work, can cause side effects, and has been dismissed by the mainstream medical community as experimentation on women. The 17-year-old was in ORR custody after arriving in the U.S. from El Salvador. She reported to immigration officials that her pregnancy was the result of rape, and a Texas judge ruled that she should be permitted to have an abortion. This ruling challenged the Trump administration's claims that the Health and Human Services Department, which oversees the Office of Refugee Resettlement, does not have to facilitate abortions. In California, San Francisco District Attorney George Gascón announced on Wednesday that the city will wipe clean the records of thousands of individuals who have been charged with marijuana-related misdemeanors and felonies over the past several decades. The announcement comes just weeks after a California measure legalizing the use of recreational marijuana went into effect. According to Gascón, a criminal conviction can be a barrier to employment, housing, and other benefits. But petitioning courts to have convictions tossed or reduced can be expensive and time-consuming. So instead of waiting, the San Francisco District Attorney's Office is taking the proactive step of throwing out the old marijuana convictions and wiping the records clean for thousands of people with nonviolent marijuana possession charges on their records. That's it for the KBOO News at Noon. Tune in today and every weekday at 5 p.m. for more local, national, and international news produced by volunteer reporters right here in KBOO's Southeast Portland studios. For KBOO News at Noon, I'm Jenka Soderberg.